Welcome, everyone joining us here tonight on the KMT Radio Club's Technical Question and Answer Net. I am Roy, AC2GS, and I will be your net control operator for this informal net. I will be your host, and Bob, KD2NVB, will be my co-host on this exploration into amateur radio technology. The purpose of this net is to provide a platform for discussion and to offer our answers, as well as promote a conversation among all participants of this net. The club maintains an archive of these technical nets on its webpages. We also offer original articles and reviews on many topics covered during these technical nets. We also publish technical puzzles for our participants to ponder and as a starting off point to discuss important technical concepts. Tonight's TechNet puzzle is posted on our club website, and the link can be found on the front page of our website in orange-colored type, but if you would like a simple URL to find it, just type into your browser puzzle.kc2rc.com. Also, we will be offering a streaming service for those who cannot receive our repeater signal. Just point your browser to stream.kc2rc.com. We also offer an EchoLink node available for use. Just point your EchoLink application to the node KC2RC-R. This net is scheduled for the second and fourth Wednesdays of each month. All of this information can also be found on our club website, which is www.kc2rc.com. Members as well as non-members are welcome to participate, although we do appreciate it when our fellow hams join our club, and as always, an application is readily available on our club's website. No question is too simple. No question is dumb. All wisdom begins with the asking of questions. If you have a question, it deserves to be answered. Our format tonight will be to ask for participants to check in only if they have questions or comments for this net. Please give us your first name, your call sign, whether you have a question or a comment. The net will then address each question in order. I will try to provide a cogent answer, and Bob, KD2NVB, will join in as well. If any other listener has any further facts or opinions, they will be free to break in with the word comment, and when recognized, offer their knowledge or experiences to us all. If anyone has any suggestions for future topics of interest, please let us know either here on the technical net or use our email address, which is tech@kc2rc.com. And now I would like to introduce my co-host for this net, Bob, KD2NVB. Good evening, Bob.
Roy, good evening, everybody on the net. Good to be here. Looking forward to the net. Back to you, Roy.
Okay, very good. I hope we have a lively net tonight. Once again, I am AC2GS. My name is Roy. This is the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. If anyone out there has any questions or topics for discussion tonight, just hit that push-to-talk button, give us your first name and your call sign, and whether it's a question or a comment. Well, once again, the silence is deafening out there. If there's one thing I can rely upon, it's our participants to kind of come a little late to the show. I understand, I realize that, you know, I'm the guy running it, so I have to look at the clock. But most people who listen to things, you know, nowadays most people don't even look at the clock to listen or watch things. They record them and they stream them at their convenience. So I guess I'm asking a wee bit too much for everyone to kind of look at their clock and say, gee, it's 9 o'clock. It's time for the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. Anyway, I certainly can stretch for time if the need requires. I've kind of made a point of saying that I really loathe and despise the new Star Trek series, Discovery and Picard, the first two seasons, and all the other Drek that has been shoveled and thrown against the wall. But I must say, the third season of Picard that has almost nothing to do with the first two seasons of Picard, thank God, is actually a very good show. It reminds me of a lot of member berries of Star Trek: The Next Generation. There are a lot of characters that were in the original series for a couple of episodes that return for a short time, and so it's a fun watch. I haven't finished watching it yet. I have about two more hours left to watch it. But it's a much better production. Apparently, they took Alec Kurtzman and locked him in his executive washroom for the entire season and did it without him. So my recommendation, if you like Star Trek and you've kind of been depressed by the new stuff, check out Picard Season 3. Hopefully this has given people time to kind of get into their desk, sit in their chair next to their radio, tune the thing up, turn it on, warm it up, what have you. So once again, I'm AC2GS. This is the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. So if you have any questions or topics for discussion, please hit that push to talk. Give me your first name or your call sign.
NVB with a quick question.
Certainly, Bob. What's your question?
It's about the new Star Trek. Is it available online or only on television? I don't have a television, so if I... Yeah, back to you. I just want to know.
It's broadcast on... what do they call that? It's a streaming service. It's CBS's streaming service for this week. I forget what. Paramount Plus. So if you have Paramount Plus, if on the other hand, you like to go yo-ho-ho and the pirate life for me type of thing, there are numerous places where one can find it.
Bring a bottle of rum. Okay, so yeah, otherwise I'd have to subscribe to yet another, I probably won't do that. I have Netflix and the Amazon Prime thing already, and also PBS.
Yeah, I wouldn't suggest encouraging them, although they have way too much encouragement because they finally have a good season of a show. They've thrown about, I've lost track, I think there's been 10 seasons of sundry bad Star Treks out there, and they finally, after all this time, got it right, again, probably because Alex Kurtzman was locked in the executive washroom and some guy called Terry Metalis actually ran the show, and he actually demonstrates that he used to watch Star Trek because he knew all this stuff, and he didn't have really absurd plot lines like Discovery at one point had sonar in space, which is an idiotic idea because sonar are sound waves, and sound waves do not travel in the vacuum of space. But then they also had tardigrades controlling time and space and fungal spores connecting all of the universe to go faster than light. There were a lot of bad ideas that the showrunner had in previous shows. But Picard season one and season two were god awful. But the third one, I don't know how it came, but Terry Metalis is a rocket scientist, I guess. I haven't finished it yet, but it tugs at all the nostalgia that you would ever want it to tug. It's a little manipulative, but it's a fun ride.
I probably watched any Star Trek except the very first, the original. I briefly had a girlfriend in 97 who... She watched the current Star Trek. It was the one where the woman was the captain of the ship. So I watched a few of those with her. But other than that, all I've watched is the original.
Yeah, the one with the woman was Captain Janeway. That was called Voyager. They actually have an actress from that show on Picard. I think she was on there, Picard season two also, but she had a much better part for season three. So that would be 7 of 9.
7 of 9 different incarnations of the Star Trek show. There've been that many. Back to you.
No, she, well, I mean, she was a Borg. She was a unified hive mind, and what they simply did was they didn't have names. Their entire identity was what number they were in certain groups of numbers. So she was a team of 9 individuals, and she was individual 7 of those 9 individuals. But Star Trek had the original show, TOS. It had The Next Generation. It had Deep Space Nine. It had Voyager. And it had Enterprise. And unfortunately, Enterprise barely made it. They used to like to do it after the first series only went 3 years. All the other series went 7 years, except Enterprise. I think they could just drag it out to 5 years, and then they just killed the poor thing. And they went on hiatus for about 15 years until they gave it to this idiot to redo. And of course, he redid it like everyone redoes things. They made it just a clone of all the other rotten science fiction. Everything is grubby and dark and dank, and people get tortured a lot. And it was very non-Star Trek. There was a lot of Star Trek. Paramount made a bunch of money off of that franchise.
So funny how the original show kind of went 3 years and seemed to bomb, and I don't know what it was. People, they somehow thought the ratings were low, and they really were. I don't know what happened. It was weird. Then it became a hit after it went off the air.
Well, among other things, you're not supposed to put shows that have any future on Friday nights. And I think it was something like Friday night at 9 o'clock or something. I mean, it was very popular with kids, but you know, I mean, they just weren't around at 9 o'clock Friday nights. And so that's where shows go to die for the most part. So although it's sort of owned by CBS, and CBS, the people producing it now, it was Paramount. It was Desilu Productions, actually, who produced it for NBC. So NBC had a hate relationship with Star Trek. They really didn't particularly care for it. They were going to cancel it by the end of the second season, and there was an enormous historic write-in campaign where NBC was deluged with, please don't cancel Star Trek. So they extended it for another year, except that the producer just kind of got bored or jaded or knew that he was on limited lifespan with it. So he phoned it in for the last year. The third season of the original Star Trek had some of the worst episodes of the 3 years. It had Leonard Nimoy walking around as Spock. Someone had invaded the starship and stolen Spock's brain. So it was absurd. But nevertheless, they sold it into syndication, and they showed it at something like 6 o'clock every day of the week. And a lot of college kids would go to the dorm and watch it every single night. And they had conventions, and people showed up for the conventions, and people wrote fanzines, and people bought books and magazines. And Gene Roddenberry was always conscious of how to make a buck, so he would sell trinkets and mimeos of scripts and all kinds of ways to make a buck. And then when Star Wars came out, everyone was looking for something in science fiction, and they looked around. They said, why don't we do Star Trek? And the rest is history.
We made those Star Trek movies as well. I have the, this is just in recent, well, the last 10, 12 years, I have these DVDs of the original show. My current girlfriend, who I've been with for 12 years, it was earlier on, maybe 10 years ago, we were watching it. We watched the whole thing at one point. And I used to watch it when I was in college, which was almost the same age as you. I mean, it was like the mid to late 70s in Miami, I was. And we watched it on this old black and white TV at dinner time. I think that's what you were talking about. I mean, that's like 10 years after it went off the air.
Yeah, the first time I watched it was in recent repeats, the summer repeats of, I think, the first or the second season. I was kind of not interested in trying it out because before Star Trek came on TV, Lost in Space did, and Lost in Space is not a very good television show. So I soured to television science fiction. I liked reading science fiction, but not necessarily watching it in TV. So I didn't watch the entire season. Then one night I had a friend, we had a sleepover or something, and he wanted to watch Star Trek. It was a Friday night, and we watched Star Trek, and I said, this is interesting. I got to look into this. So I watched the rest of the second and then the third season, and then it was canceled. And then I listened locally. It was PIX, Channel 11, running the syndicated episodes 5 days a week, and I would watch those. I bought the VHS of Star Trek. I bought the Laserdisc of Star Trek, and I bought the DVD of Star Trek. So they got a lot of my money.
Maybe we should see if anyone's out there now. What do you think, Roy?
That would be a very nice thing to see. So if you're out there, I am always AC2GS. My name is Roy. This is the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. It is not a movie review or a television review service, but we'll talk about almost anything if we're stuck for a topic. But if you're out there and you actually have a technical question or a topic for a discussion tonight, that would be nice. So if you do, please hit that push to talk and tell me your first name and your call sign.
C2ZV, hi Roy.
Hey, hello, 32MYF. I have a comment or a question for discussion.
Okay, Berlot, please give me your question for discussion.
Okay, I found it very hard to kind of talk to people about AM radio and get them interested in the hobby. My question for discussion is, I would love to know the history of, like, people getting involved. Were there more people in engineering? And, you know, do you feel that the internet option, like, people have to communicate decreased the involvement in AM radio? Because, you know, I'm trying to get to the bottom of that so we can have more members and more people to participate, but I found it very difficult to have people get, you know, coming in this hobby.
Okay, very good. That's a good topic. Amateur radio has a history that goes back more than about 120 years, 130 years. Early on, there was no practical use for radio waves. And so guys would just put things together themselves. Some of them would later go on to become manufacturers and construct these things and sell them to their fellow hobbyists and make a couple of dollars. But, you know, those were the really bad days of spark gap transmitters that had no particular frequency. They produced a lot of noise. The only tuning device in an early spark gap was the length of your antenna. The resonance of your antenna kind of determined where the noise tended to be. And you didn't even have amplitude modulation. You had basically CW, Morse code at the very best. And the earliest devices didn't even have that. They had things called coherers, which was just iron filings that would clump up under the influence of received RF energy, and you'd have to shake them loose and wait for them to clump up again as another signal. But as time went on, they invented the vacuum tube, they invented the amplifier, they invented amplitude modulation and frequency modulation. And the only reason why we're on the bands that we are on today is because they thought it was a very good maritime tool. So the Navy took charge before the FCC ever existed of the radio waves and took all the good frequencies for themselves and gave us 160 meters and above, which they felt were worthless. So the hobbyists played around with 160 meters and 80 meters and 40 meters and 20 meters and 10 meters and did good things with it. The problem is that modern technology has jaded everyone. When I was a kid, there were kind of two broad paths, well, three broad paths into this hobby. One was vets who were in the Signal Corps and got used to playing with radios and took that as a hobby when they got out of the Army, Navy, Marines, Air Force, what have you. The other two were shortwave listeners, which is what I was. I had a shortwave radio when I was a kid, and I listened to a bunch of things, and one that I really enjoyed was listening to the ham bands. And then you had the other guys who were citizens band people, and that was their first, you know, they knew people who were in citizen band. They didn't really have to take an exam. They just had to pay a little fee, and a lot of them didn't even bother to pay a fee. They didn't use their license. They used their nicknames, and they ran illegal power. And, you know, again, yo-ho-ho, little piratey. Let me drop for a sec. Okay, hopefully I'm not going to burn out the repeater. So the problem is that's where you get a lot of the 60s and the 70s and the 80-year-old guys. The problem is getting the youngsters or getting the 20-year-olds and the 30-year-olds. The average person that you talk about, that you say amateur radio, they don't know what you're talking about, usually. About, I'd say about 95% will say, I don't know what you're talking about. A couple percent will say, I remember my great uncle would sit in the basement, you know, without a T-shirt on and talk to people with a machine that had a lot of vacuum tubes. So, you know, that's a kind of not the greatest public relations. So it's deeply problematic. We had a couple of guys interview us at a club meeting and talk about the hobby. And the only thing that I could get a rise with any of these people is moon bounce. Because, you know, if you tell people that you talk to Namibia, which I talked to Namibia about 3 weeks ago, they would pull out their cell phone and they'll say, I can talk to Namibia right now. You know, contact with anyone on the earth, you know, anyone could do it with a cell phone. But moon bounce, you can't quite do that with a cell phone yet. You know, the benefits are kind of dubious, but you can bounce signals off asteroids in the moon. So that's my go-to gee whiz explanation of what you could do with amateur radio. Although there's a lot of other things that most kids aren't impressed by, unfortunately.
Yeah, thank you, Roy. I'm so happy the way that you describe it. It's exactly what you just said. They are not impressed by radio. I figure out, like, what I was pitching, you know, with was you can use it in case of emergency. I don't think that, you know, that works anymore. So I don't know what advice you have in terms of, you know, educating someone and have, you know, something strong that I can say to kind of motivate people instead of you can use it in case of emergency. Back to you, KD2MYF.
AC2GS. I don't know exactly what to tell you. I mean, when I'm trying to kind of project my interests, I tend to get into the technical understanding. You know, I mean, some people don't care. You know, they have a television set, and if you were to ask them how the TV works, they would tell you with a straight face, I plug it in, I turn it on, I watch it. That's how it works. They're not interested in the details. I've always been interested in the details. You know, I take everything apart to try and figure out how it works. I've had the ability to do that as a physician in medical school with a human body. So, you know, I do it with radios. I've done it with telephones. I've done it with all kinds of things. But sometimes that intellectual curiosity just isn't there, and you can't really use that as a means to interest people. Sometimes it's just the randomness of contacts. It's meeting new and interesting people. I mean, people, very often kids will kind of say that they don't really want to meet new and interesting people, and they don't want to talk to them, they want to text them. You know, society is weird. We go through different stages. Back in the 1800s, most conversations were done by writing letters back and forth, and some letters were beautiful works of art. Then the telephone was invented, and everyone stopped writing and just talked on the telephone. And now we have a society that thinks that communication is 144 letters at a time. So, you know, culture changes. So it's not that easy. And sometimes you have to kind of fine tune your pitch to the person you're trying to throw it to. You know, if they're technical people, you take the technical approach. If they're social people, you take the social approach. And if they're gee whiz, you throw the moon bounce in.
ZV.
Yes, William.
Hi, Roy. Can you hear me all right?
I can hear you fine. It's just the strange way that this is set up at my shack. Sometimes the push-to-talk button works, and sometimes it doesn't. So sometimes I have to repeat myself.
Okay. Anyway, I like the way you guys were talking about ham radio and trying to get more people involved. I've tried that, and I don't know. It seems like nobody really understands anything about radio at all.
Well, but in my opinion, unfortunately, that isn't the whole thing. I wouldn't mind if they don't understand, but they don't care. That's the important thing. It's not that people are stupid. It's that people are ignorant, and that they're perfectly happy with their continued ignorance. That's what kind of annoys me at times. Again, because that's not my nature, and I tend to just reflect off my own nature.
I'm kind of like you in a lot of ways. I got to know how everything works. So radio in my younger days was the only thing out there to figure out. Now, I think there's so much to figure out, you just have to give up, and it's just too much for you. And there's no way you're ever going to figure out what code is or anything like that. So unless you specialize, you don't know anything, and everything else is magic.
Well, I don't know. It kind of depends. In medicine, we have this old line that I've used far too many times to far too many people. I'm a generalist. You know, there are specialists, there are generalists. And the line goes, generalists learn less and less about more and more until they know almost nothing about almost everything. Specialists are people who learn more and more about less and less until they know almost everything about almost nothing. I kind of have a diverse curiosity and hopefully an understanding on how diverse things tend to work. I'm not a specialist in the field. You know, I could cobble together some code. But I wouldn't be considered a full-time programmer. And, you know, I dabble in quantum mechanics when I have to, or relativity if I have to and such. You know, it only takes a curiosity. That's all. I mean, we live in an information age where if you're slightly curious, you could go on the Internet and read tens of thousands of pages on any subject that you could imagine.
Or watch videos about it endlessly as well.
Yeah. There's a lot of material, both written and audio and video. Unfortunately, what I tell people is you need to have a well-calibrated BS meter, because for some odd reason, when it comes to amateur radio, I find that, unfortunately, at least something like 40%, sometimes 60% of the stuff is nonsense, is dribble, is complete idiocy. Because everyone out there kind of thinks they know stuff because someone sort of told them something like that at one point, they think, maybe. And so I try not to watch too much ham radio YouTubes because of the preponderance of people saying really stupid things on them.
I get the same thing off the internet when I search for an answer for a question. There's so many dead ends. It's like there's some lame. It's like, why doesn't Apple just answer simple questions? They answer it. It doesn't. Their answer isn't what I'm looking for. And then everybody else has 10,000 people have the same question, no answers, and it's just ridiculous. Then you see something, you think, oh, maybe this might be sort of like it. It's just crazy.
Comment.
Yes, comment.
Comment 82 to you.
Yes, Alex, please comment away.
So I think some of the communities that are around the YouTube people have been helpful to me. Like the Discord of a couple of the popular YouTubers is always, like, you know, the chat room always active and full of people that you can ask questions to. I found that pretty helpful, like, you know, because otherwise, who else is around? You'd have to email someone. Over.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of other options that we haven't really talked about that are somewhat more interactive. When I was younger, the thing was forums. I had CompuServe, was a time-sharing network pre-internet. Where you posted subjects and discoursed about them back and forth and met interesting people. I had conversations about computer technology with guys who were based in Saudi Arabia, of all places. And there was another guy whose father was a physician only about 2 miles away from my home. And so we had forums. But now you have Reddit and you have Discord, and there's a whole bunch of other means to interact, mostly on a text-based nature. Again, sometimes you're going to get very, very smart people, and sometimes you're going to get people who just learn bad factoids and like to repeat them back at each other. So you need a good BS meter generally, but yeah, that's another source. And also it kind of filters out some of the what we call in my shul ultakakas. You know, because you're not going to get many 80-year-old guys who are going to be hanging out on a Discord. As it is, probably at my age, there's not a lot of people my age on Discords, except, you know, there's a Discord that is for people who are giving VE exams. So it probably skews a little bit older than the average Discord.
2ZV.
Yes, William.
Hey, Roy, I got a comment on your BS meter, and I'd like to know the bandwidth, frequency, and power of your personal BS meter.
I'm unaware of the units that the proper BS meter. It's sort of a null meter, you know, where you know, if it reads zero, then you're in good. But there are guys out there who pin my BS meter, and that's never a good thing.
Fantastic. I think we need more of those out on the ham radio networks.
Well, yeah, I agree with you. It's a touch risque for the FCC. I remember I used to use that phrase on the technical net with Dick, who never said a vulgar thing in his life, who actually would repeat my term of a BS meter. So it's an important thing to have because, again, most other things people won't BS about. You know, there are some people out there who will BS about quantum mechanics and relativity, but they're very few and far between. But you go on 75 meters, and it is not at all unusual for at least 20% of the people with opinions and advice to be complete idiots.
Wow, that's interesting. You know, I'm thinking that what kind of connectors does your BS meter have, and does it have an antenna?
No, it does not have either. It has eyes and ears. Fortunately, I've never had to calibrate my nose for the BS meter, but eyes and ears. You know, if it looks a little wonky, if it sounds very wonky, it's usually wonky.
Aside from that, I did have a question, so if nobody else has any questions, why don't you call out and then I can come back later.
Alex, did we respond to your question? Well, I don't know. Nothing heard. Berlot, anything further with your question? I wish I had a quick, easy solution for you. I mean, I tried to distill it as best I could in the pamphlet that I gave you last year and the year before for the field day, because that's kind of my best attempt at cajoling people who aren't already interested in the hobby. It's a lot easier to kind of deal with people who have a vague interest. They had a relative who was into the hobby or some other contact, so you don't have to explain things to them. It's just a matter of giving them an opportunity to ask questions and answer them as best I could.
I think that's a good thing you mentioned, the pamphlet. As a matter of fact, I will try to have, you know, some copies, even for people who are already armed, they can still use, like, especially the history of armed radio. So I think it's a good thing. We can still promote that, as you said, if people are interested. They are interested, but at least the information will be available to them. But it's sad that, you know, I think the hobby can be useful, but nowadays with, you know, everything that is out there, people don't seem so kind of, you know, want to have, you know, a radio or those things.
Yeah, I mean, it's a two-edged sword. Unfortunately, what we end up happening is we get people who kind of are self-defined as preppers. They're expecting a civil war or the end of the world or something, some kind of terrible emergency. And so they'll. I think that is the reason why, weirdly, most of the world licenses in amateur radio are going down, but in the United States, they're going up. And there are about 750,000 licensed amateur radios in the United States. The overwhelming majority of them are technician class. And I think the reason for that is a lot of those people are preppers who are just looking for UHF and VHF frequencies, so that they could walk around with an extra walkie-talkie that doesn't kind of coincide with GMRS and other standard types of radios. So you know, that's the unfortunate demographics. It's very difficult. At one point or another, I suggested to the club that we set up a booth at these maker fairs, because the closest thing that kids have to the interest in amateur radio are maker places, where they're looking at servos and telemetry and balloons and cameras and all kinds of things. And you can easily tack on amateur radio frequencies to a lot of those things and get in the door. That was just around the time that the maker fairs all went bankrupt, and that ended that idea.
So what is your best advice, you know, right now? Let's say that we want to kind of present AM radio to the public. As of now, what do you think, you know, what type of techniques should be used? What type of equipment should be used for the general public to kind of get a taste of AM radio?
Okay, I mean, AC2GS, by the way, this is where I often have disagreements with some other club members. In the very old days, it was not at all uncommon to set up a temporary card table, put a radio on the card table, put a mag mount on your car next to the card table, and talk to the repeater. Maybe in 1970 that would impress someone. In 2020, in 2023, it ain't going to impress anyone. So I unfortunately don't really see any equipment that is going to interest non-believers. you know, people who are into radios or historical radios, yeah, sure. You show them a Collins and they look real pretty. Show them a D-104 microphone, chrome and gold and all kinds of things, and, you know, they'll be in love. But the average person who has no knowledge or interest, I can't think of any piece of gear that would impress them. Most gear looks kind of the same as, you know, there's sort of two different ways that gear goes. The modern way, my Flex radio would not be attractive to most people. It barely has any dials or knobs or buttons. The old-fashioned one with a lot of dials and knobs and buttons, most young kids would look at it and say, eh, you know, they're used to control surfaces, flat surfaces like a tablet and a phone and things. So lots of luck impressing them with equipment. I can't imagine any piece of modern-day equipment that'll impress youngsters.
2ZV.
Yes, William?
I really think that the old equipment is really impressive, and I really like dials. I have this silly, stupid antenna tuner that has these giant knobs with gears on them, and they're weighted knobs. It's, like, really cool to be able to turn something like that rather than touch a surface. I think people are missing out on so much.
Well, I understand your thoughts, and I know a lot of amateur radio operators who, again, they don't like my radio. One guy who was into moon bounce when moon bounce was a really complicated affair, Joe Taylor's algorithms for data transmission have made life a lot easier for modern-day moon bounces. But the old-timers, one of them told me that he wouldn't want a pan adapter. He doesn't want to see a signal. He told me the only way to really find a signal is to listen for it. Turn the dial and listen for it. The idea that you see it on a computer screen and you click your mouse and it goes to the right frequency annoyed him, if anything. So, you know, it bespeaks our age, unfortunately. 15-year-old kids don't like dials or knobs. They like control surfaces. Guys our age like dials and knobs.
I have to deal with both, and so I still appreciate a good switch.
Okay, but I'm telling you, if you got together 115-year-olds and you asked them which would they rather have and showed them something with a control surface and another thing with 150 buttons and knobs and dials on them, they would probably gravitate towards the control surfaces. I mean, people have been seeing control surfaces as far back as, you know, Star Trek The Next Generation, before control surfaces were really a big thing, and they were faking it. They were basically backlighting plexiglass with some masks covering up some areas. But that turned out to be the future. So, again, I understand, you know, people are used to what they're used to. When you were growing up, no one had anything like control surfaces. So you learn to love your knobs and dials and such. And now that most devices are control surfaces, this generation is into that. Who knows what kind of tactile display control devices will be designed and popular 20, 30 years from now that will confuse their Zoomer parents.
Well, actually, I really think that control surfaces are great. And sorry, it's getting feedback into the echoing. I think control surfaces are great. But you know what I think also interesting is if there was like some kind of flex radio that would plug into an iPad and then you get a pen adapter or something like that and have that, you know, very small thing that you could hook to an antenna. So do you know something like there's a little small box that you could hook to an iPad and then get something with a pen adapter on it that would actually work?
Uh, I don't know exactly how small is required. My radio, which I would not call small, it's not big, but I have a 6700, and it basically can do that on my iPad. It can do that on my iPhone. There's no particular reason why SDRs can't be configured to go into a network and go wireless router and do those things.
So there might be a direct connection between the little lightning connector on the bottom and some kind of little box.
I guess theoretically you could do something like that. Nowadays, I think people would try not to do it like that because it's a lot more convenient if you have a wireless connection than if you have a wired connection.
Deal is your radio is able to stick a full interface on an iPad, so you can be sitting in the living room and like use the Flex Radio interface directly like that, and have the other stuff like in the ham shack.
In a word, yes.
I heard somebody out there saying repeat.
I didn't hear anyone say repeat, but in a word, yes. That is what I am able to do. I can do it on an iPhone. It's kind of little tiny display, but I can do it on an iPad. And you can even do FT8. It has built-in FT8 detection, and you can transmit FT8. And, you know, it has DX cluster capability and all kinds of fun little doodads. And for people who like knobs, dials, and buttons, there are external Bluetooth devices that you can register with the program on iPad and hit buttons if you're into buttons.
Awesome. All we all need is a spare $10,000, right?
Well, I mean, my 6700 was top of the line when I bought it, but, you know, they sell the 6400 and the 6600, so it doesn't necessarily cost, you know, I don't know the exact price of the lowest Flex radio, probably $3,000 or $4,000. And I'm sure as time goes on, more of the other manufacturers will be engineering. They're all really building software-defined radios. It's just a matter of them building in a interface or an app for cell phones and iPads and such. I'm not really that familiar with each and individual brand, how much that they've been able to do. But there have been examples of that, and even places like MFJ sells a kind of rig control device called, I think, the 123, which is easy to remember. I don't remember if it has a pan adapter or not, but it's certainly the future of radio. I easily see guys who will be able to both remote locally into their radio or remote long distance using internet connections.
I know exactly what you mean, because when I was a radio engineer, we always had the spectrum analyzer turned on. It was always hooked on the receive side of the antenna, and you're always watching everything. You could see what was going on the satellite and stuff like that, and you switch it around all over the station. So, you know, I think a pan adapter is like having something more convenient than that, that you can actually go, oh, there's a signal, ding, got it. So that's really cool. Anyway, maybe I'll get a great tax refund.
Well, I hope you do. I hope you do. Yeah, it's loads of fun, and it's kind of, in a way, to me, educational. On the good old days when I had a fan dipole up, which covered most of the HF band, I could have on my screen either 2 meters or 70 centimeters, and then all the bands of HF, 10, 20, 40, 80, at one time, and you could look at all the pan adapters in one fell swoop and give a good idea of, you know, whether it was a contest day and there was a lot of transmissions going on, or if things were just dead in the water. So those were fun days.
That brings up a technical question with me. So let's say I had one of these little spectrum analyzers that worked fine you know, when I hook it up to my antenna, and I'm able to see the band, the 140 megahertz band, and, you know, other, like, wideband stuff like that hooked up to my antenna. What would I have to do to be able to leave that hooked up to my antenna and also transmit at the same time without blowing out the spectrum analyzer?
Ultimately, as long as you only using one antenna, you can't really do anything useful. Theoretically, you could use a splitter, but the splitter is going to reflect back into the receiver, the transmitted portion, to some degree, and I wouldn't risk the front end of my receiver on something like that. So what most people tend to do is they have what's called the TR switch, transmit, receive. And where you have one antenna and it's hooked up to a receiver and a transmitter, and it can detect what you're doing. It's usually toggled with the push to talk button. So it normally defaults to connection to the receiver. When you hit the push to talk, it switches the relay and takes the receiver out of line and replaces it with the transmitter signal. So that way you're not getting reflections back into the front end of the receiver.
No, but this little HD doesn't have any PTT output. Maybe you have to wire up the microphone or something. And I was hoping you might know something. Maybe there was a RF sensing, like click-off kind of magic nanosecond switch or something with the limiter, you know, I don't know, packets. Yeah, making it up.
No, not necessarily making it up. They do sell TR switches that use RF sensing. So as soon as they sense the slightest bit of RF energy, they engage the relays for radios where you can't kind of deal with a push to talk button.
That's the same problem. I have two HTs. I want to be able to monitor the input frequency and the output frequency, you know, on the same antenna with, I don't know how that would work, you know, so I could hear the input and the output at the same time.
Well, again, ultimately, that's a big problem. The only real practical way of listening to your signal, I mean, there are people who do this, especially for repeaters. Dick, K2RIW, he would talk on the input for the repeater, and he would also listen to the output of the repeater. That's 600 kilohertz offset. The trick to that is having two antennas far enough apart where they don't, where the transmitter doesn't desense the receiver. If you have it far enough apart, you can get away with it. And Dick had a lot of land, and he was up on a hill, and he was able to accomplish that. Although it does introduce timing errors, so you don't hear the output of the repeater at the same time that you're saying it into the input of the repeater. So that fraction of a second difference can confuse people. There used to be an app on cell phones where it would introduce a little delay and play back your voice, and most people were tongue-tied just listening to, you know, what they said about half a second earlier being repeated to them as they're trying to put words together at the same time.
Yeah, I know all about it. I tested echo suppressors over the satellite for many years back in the early days when they didn't work. So, you know, even right now what's happening, I can hear myself coming in on Echolink at about a half a second delay, and then when you talk, I don't get any delay on Echolink, which is weird because it seems to come in at the radio and the Echolink almost at the same time. So I think your ham setup might be quite interesting over there.
Well, I think the thing that's happening, and the reason for that is I'm not kind of taking the long road through Echolink. I'm feeding this signal directly at the nodes point, where you're going from your node to my node to the radio. So my trip is a little shorter than yours. That's why it has probably less latency errors.
That's really interesting. Maybe somebody else got some questions for the TechNet. I still have another question for you, though.
Okay, we'll open it up for the rest of the gang listening. If anyone else out there has any questions or comments tonight, please hit that push to talk and give me your first name and your call sign. Well, I think we have time for you, William.
I wanted to go back to Berlot's topic for a second about the field day. And my question was, maybe in our next meeting we can share like who is actually going to come to the field day and what's happening with it, because I think Frank has got a trailer. Maybe he's bringing it this year. I don't know who's bringing what radios, what's going to happen. Is there some organizational activities that we need to discuss? Are people signed up? I have no idea.
Well, I would assume that this is going to be part of the conversation. I include it in the agenda for every month up until, you know, July. Usually July is discuss results of field day, and then we drop field day until the following January or February, and we pick it up, and every month we have it on the agenda. So I'm sure there'll be some information available. You know, the most important people to know these things are the organizers. But any interested person who wants to show up on the next meeting can ask Berlot. She's the chairman of the Field Day Committee, and figure out what's going on.
I don't know. The thing is that I know there's a form, but I mean, there's no report on how many people filled out what form, who's coming, what's going to happen. Berlot says maybe somebody can help me get there with a ride. I don't know if anybody's actually going to do that. You know, so there's a lot of questions I still have. But we'll pick it up at the club meeting. But this is the kind of question I was wondering if we could at least have at least how many people, how many forms have been signed up, what's going on, you know?
Well, again, probably the best person that you could ask would be Berlot, because when you fill out a form, I think it gets sent, a copy gets sent to her. So she's keeping records of it. I'm not keeping records of it because no one asked me to keep records of it. So, you know, I always keep records of a lot of other things. But since there is a field day committee, I assume that the field day committee takes care of that stuff.
That I'll just check in with Berlot. And okay, so before I close here, I was listening to the ARES, and there was another guy on there talking to Simon that was really interesting. They were talking about the ability of training AI to listen to static. What do you think about that?
I'm not quite sure what the point of that. I mean, unless the point of that is to come up with an AI-derived noise decreasing algorithm, which I think is probably in the cards eventually as artificial intelligence gets better and better and it's used for more and more and more things. Building up an AI-based noise reduction algorithm will probably be an important thing that people will work on as well. So I see that as a future development. I mean, there's all kinds of interesting things that you can extrapolate with artificial intelligence and such. Eventually, they might be able to both neutralize the noise and interpret the sounds as human speech and give you a perfect record of the conversation, you know, without the background noise. You know, give it enough time, imagination, and silicon, who knows what you can do.
I wonder if we could do it in under 500 millisecond delay. Anyway, thanks a lot for the TechNet discussion. The one thing about the, you know, listening to the input frequency and the output, I can tell you that 15 feet between the antenna on the air conditioner and the antenna on the HT doesn't work. How far apart do you think those antennas need to be?
Well, ultimately, it depends upon how badly your radios desense. Some radios are kind of the front ends are wide open, and it's too easy to desense them. So in those cases, you probably would need to get them, 60 feet apart. If you happen to have radios that don't have too much of a desensing problem, you might get away with about 40 feet. But when you get to things like 20 feet and 15 feet, I've never heard of anyone who is able to pull it off.
I need actually, for like these little dinky 8-watt radios, I'd need actually a low-loss coax that would be about 60, 80 feet long to get out from where the radio is up to an antenna on the roof or something to really be able to do what I'm talking about, right?
Yeah, I mean, if you're going to go a far distance, you have to keep in mind the attenuation loss. It's less important for VHF than UHF. But sometimes you can go a little crazy about things like that. I know a guy who didn't even want LMR 400 or LMR 600. He decided on a solid copper shielding coax. LMR 400, unless you have outlandish lengths, shouldn't give you that much attenuation loss. Now, every so often, I will bump into someone on a TechNet who says that, they have 60 feet of RG58. For 70 centimeters, which is foolish. At that point, most of your energy is being taken up as attenuation loss. RG58 is great in your car. Your car doesn't need more than, 8 feet of coax? But using RG58, although it's inexpensive and very flexible, it has a high attenuation loss. You run it 80, 90 feet, and a lot of that signal goes up in heat. It certainly doesn't go out of your antenna.
Yeah, okay, so I just need to think about how I'm going to be able to develop things over here. Anyway, thanks a lot for your help, Roy. I really appreciate the TechNet, and it's great talking to you. And maybe if Berlot's still online, she could chime in, or I'll call back and talk to her later.
Okay, very good. We still have our TechNet puzzle, but I'll ask if anyone else has any questions or comments for tonight before we do the TechNet puzzle.
Berlot, 32MYF. I have an answer for William. On next Wednesday during the meeting, I will provide a report on how many people sign in, and if you know any other members, encourage them to sign in so they can be part of the report. So people do sign in, and I do keep, I do keep, record of that. Back to you, 32MYF.
Okay, very good, Berlot. Once again, anyone with any questions or comments before we move on to the TechNet puzzle tonight? It's a simple, short one. It doesn't require any illustrations. It's all in text and should go rather quickly. Okay. The question is, let's see, a single sideband transceiver switched to lower sideband is being bench tested into a dummy load. A 1 kilohertz signal is fed to the microphone socket. If the display shows 3.700 megahertz, the output frequency will be, and you have four choices, the output frequency will be A, 3.690 megahertz, B, 3.699 megahertz, C, 3.702 megahertz, and D, 3.730 megahertz. So again, a single sideband transceiver switched to lower sideband is being bench tested into a dummy load. A 1 kilohertz signal is fed to the microphone socket. If the display shows 3.700 megahertz, the output frequency will be. Anyone want to hazard a guess?
Hey, Bob, are you out there? You usually like to guess.
Yeah, I'm here. I can hazard a guess, but it'll just be a guess. Anyone else has a more educated guess? I can do one that might look obvious to me. It might be a trick. I'll leave it at that for the moment.
I think you should give some more hints.
I really don't think it requires any hints, and I wouldn't even hazard a guess other than tell you the answer what a hint would be.
Bob, you got 10 seconds, and then I'll try to answer for the thing. Give me your best shot.
You want me to be? I'll guess if you want. I would just say 3.699 just because it's 1 megahertz off, but maybe that's not how that works. So that is my guess, but I don't, it's just a guess. Back to net.
I'm with you on that. Let's see what Roy says.
Yes, indeed. The answer is 3.699. The whole point of sidebands is sidebands are the sum and difference of the carrier frequency and the modulating audio frequency. So your carrier frequency by this question is 3.700 megahertz, and you are modulating it with a 1 kilohertz modulating signal. So you're going to get an upper sideband at 3.701, and you're going to get a lower sideband at 3.699. So, and since the question was, well, what is the lower sideband, the answer is B, 3.699. So you're quite right.
Now that you see it that way, it's obvious. Now I just realize what modulating means and all that. I mean, I should have known before. It somehow didn't register. Okay, very good.
It's okay. I mean, I find these little questions, and it's a topic for a little refresh. Everyone can use a little refresh. So once again, I am AC2GS. My name is Roy. This is the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. We're here every Wednesday night at 9 p.m. until we run out of steam. So if there's anyone with any further questions, topics, or comments to make before we call it a night, this is your opportunity. Hit that push to talk. Give us your first name and your call sign. Very well. This net has been brought to you by the Kings County Radio Club. Our club is an ARRL-affiliated club based in Brooklyn, New York. We meet on the first Wednesday of each month. Our next meeting will be May 3rd, which will be held by teleconference. Club members will be emailed. They already have been emailed with the details of logging into the meeting. Non-members wishing to join a general club meeting can email me, AC2GS, with some form of identification. We can accept anonymous email requests. For the required link, although our meetings informally begin after 7 p.m., the formal regular general meeting starts at 8 p.m. and continues until anywhere from 9 to 10 o'clock, depending upon the number of points that are covered. We have a weekly 2-meter club net on every Tuesday night at 9 p.m. on this repeater. And as I mentioned earlier, this technical net meets on the second and fourth Wednesday of each month at 9 p.m. We also sponsor a 10-meter net every Sunday morning at 11 a.m. on 28.380 megahertz upper sideband or nearby there. We also offer an audio stream of our KC2RC repeater on the internet, as well as our 10-meter net. Just type into your browser stream.kc2rc.com. Members as well as non-members are welcome to participate, although we do appreciate it when our fellow hams join our club, and as always, an application is readily available on our club's website. If you would like to contact the host of this technical net, simply address your email to tech@kc2rc.com. We maintain an active website at www.kingscountyradioclub.com or www.kc2rc.com, which offers archives of this technical net, amateur radio news, original articles, and technical forums. Please visit our website and participate. Our website hosting services were generously donated by the local Brooklyn-based web hosting company, Three Aliens Web Hosting, who we would like to thank. As the great philosopher Jimi Hendrix once said, knowledge speaks but wisdom listens. So try to listen a bit more and talk a bit less. It's time to roll this all up and shut this all down, but we'll be back to do it all over again on May 10th, and you're all welcome to join us. Thanks to all the people that participated tonight, especially my co-host, Bob, KD2NVB. Without you guys, I would just be talking to myself. So, this is Roy, AC2GS, going clear and getting the heck out of here. Have a great time, have a great week, and please consider coming for the meeting next Wednesday, where we're going to have a lot of interesting things to discuss. So be well. This is AC2GS formally closing this episode of the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net, and I am clear.